The Federal News Update for Thursday, January 8, 2026. Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we deliver the exhaustive, granular record of U.S. federal government activity. This isn't just a summary. This is a full-spectrum archive of policy, power, and political for fracture, specifically tailored for you. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, ready to provide the necessary context and technical depth. Our mission today, as always, is maximum information density. We're going to be sifting through some really aggressive power pivots from the executive branch, complex legislative breakdowns, and these really granular shifts happening across every federal agency.
And I mean every agency, from the newly named Department of War all the way down to the National Center for Education Statistics.
Exactly.
Because January 8th, 2026 was not a slow news day. It really feels like it was a day where the administration formally declared its intent to operate under a fundamentally new strategic posture, both, you know, internationally and at home.
That's right. We're tracking a high-stakes convergence of unilateral geopolitical action and some deeply volatile domestic conflicts.
So we have to start at the top, where that pivot is being signaled most aggressively. The renaming of the Department of Defense.
That is precisely where we must begin. Because, you know, this isn't just semantics. It's not just a name change. It's a structural, it's a doctrinal shift. We are talking about the full operationalization of the Department of War.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately. This renaming was authorized months ago, but what happened yesterday confirms its full implementation. And crucially, what's the specific technical language that's governing this change?
So the full operational implementation was confirmed across the executive branch yesterday. It's executing the mandate that was established by Executive Order 14347. President Trump signed that back on September 5, 2025. The core action is the renaming, but the really crucial technical detail is in the language they use to enforce it, especially since Congress hasn't acted yet.
Wait, so if Congress hasn't acted, then the statutory name is still Department of Defense. How does the executive branch get around that? How do they enforce Department of War usage without, you know, breaking the law?
They navigated it with some real bureaucratic precision. The directive establishes the title Department of War as the secondary, but, and this is the key part, the explicitly preferred title for non-statutory purposes.
Non-statutory purposes. So what does that mean in practice?
It means they can enforce it on everything that isn't a law. All non-legislative communications, internal guidance, press releases, external messaging. It lets them sidestep the legal appropriation lines for now, while basically forcing Congress to eventually codify the change.
That sounds like a long-term bureaucratic nightmare, trying to operate under two official names at the same time. But what's the tangible, visible proof that this transition is fully operationalized now?
The most immediate and expensive proof is the complete digital migration. Official communications, press releases, all public-facing information, and most significantly, the entire internal digital infrastructure. It's all migrated to the war.gov domain.
So it's not just a memo, it's a hard technical pivot.
It's a hard pivot. And the cost of this commitment is just staggering. Internal estimates from late 2025 projected the implementation costs, and that includes replacing signage, updating all digital assets, retraining personnel would approach $2 billion USD.
$2 billion, solely for a name change. That is a monumental expense. I mean, that level of spending has to be justified by an equally monumental strategic objective. What is the stated justification for reversing 75 years of policy?
The justification is a very explicit, very aggressive critique of history. The White House fact sheet argues that the original 1949 renaming from the War Department to the DOD signaled a posture of passivity, of hesitation. The administration claims that this defense nomenclature resulted in prolonged conflicts, whereas the pre-1947 War Department era was all about decisive, offensive engagement. They're specifically referencing World War II as the model.
And the man leading this ideological charge, Secretary Pete Hegseth, is now formally styled as the Secretary of War in all executive correspondence. What's his specific language on the purpose of this shift?
Secretary Hegseth champions it as a restoration of readiness and resolve. He's been very clear that the name change is designed not just for internal culture, but as an unambiguous signal to global adversaries. The message is, you know, the U.S. is willing to wage war to secure American objectives. It's all about emphasizing an offensive doctrine over just deterrence.
So the impact is a full doctrinal pivot.
Mm-hmm.
But what does this dual nomenclature mean for the department's actual day-to-day operations?
Mm.
I mean, how does the statutory name remaining Department of Defense actually complicate things?
The operational friction is immediate and it's intense. Every single appropriations bill, every statutory authority granted by Congress refers to the Department of Defense. So that forces the department's legal teams and the Office of Management and Budget to constantly manage this bifurcation.
And internationally.
Think about international agreements. Treaties signed by the DOD, they now have to clarify in every single communication whether they're operating under the statutory authority of the DOD or the preferred nomenclature of the Department of War. It subtly strains interagency relationships, too. It forces the State Department, the Justice Department, the whole intelligence community to adopt the war lexicon, which can't help but shift their focus toward more kinetic, more aggressive definitions of their own objectives.
That provides crucial context for the structural change. Okay, so let's connect this new Department of War identity directly to the most high-stakes, kinetic action currently underway.
Yeah.
The Venezuela intervention strategy. This feels like where the new doctrine is being tested in the field.
Exactly. The strategy was outlined in exhaustive detail yesterday. It was a joint briefing by Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Secretary of War Pete Hegseth. This is a comprehensive three-phase stabilization plan, and it was initiated right after the successful operation that led to the implied capture of Nicolas Maduro. They're calling it Operation Absolute Resolve.
Okay, lay out those three phases for us. Let's start with the immediate military and economic actions happening right now in phase one.
Phase one is stabilization. The primary objective here is preventing a chaotic collapse in Venezuela and at the same time asserting financial and kinetic control. The central action is the enforcement of a naval quarantine, or what is effectively a blockade, in the Caribbean.
And this blockade is active.
Very active. Secretary Hegseth confirmed its vigor yesterday, announcing the seizure of two additional oil tankers overnight. This action is aggressive because the U.S. is now seizing Venezuelan sovereign assets. The total inventory of oil currently immobilized by this quarantine and now under de facto U.S. control is estimated to be between 30 and 50 million barrels.
30 to 50 million barrels. That is a massive volume of oil. What is the administration's stated financial plan for those assets?
The plan is explicit. Control the revenue stream completely. The seized oil will be sold at market rates, not the heavily discounted rates that were previously offered to allies like China and Russia. The administration stated that the proceeds will be strictly controlled and dispersed by the United States.
And the justification for that?
The stated justification is to ensure the funds benefit the Venezuelan people and aren't diverted to the remnants of the Maduro regime or, you know, corrupt networks. We also heard from the U.S. Energy Secretary, who indicated that the U.S. plans to be the sole supplier of diluent, the materials needed to process that heavy Venezuelan crude, and will sell the oil indefinitely.
Wait, if the U.S. is controlling the sale of 50 million barrels, selling it at market rates, and supplying the diluent needed to get it out of the ground, doesn't that make the U.S. a deliberate high-volume market maker in global oil? What does this mean for Brent crude futures?
It absolutely positions the U.S. to influence price stability, particularly in a volatile geopolitical environment. 50 million barrels is a significant buffer. A controlled release could either stabilize prices during a crunch, or if they release it rapidly, it could push global prices down slightly. But the administration is expected to manage the flow very carefully to maximize revenue. And crucially, this whole operation also ensures that American and allied firms get immediate access to the entire supply chain, from extraction and dilution to transport and sales.
So phase one establishes kinetic and financial control. What transitions us into phase two?
Phase two is recovery and economic reintegration. This phase shifts the focus to rebuilding the domestic economy. Secretary Rubio outlined mandates that require market access for American, Western, and other companies that align with U.S. objectives. At the same time, phase two is meant to initiate a national reconciliation process, you know, designed to bring back exiles, offer amnesty, and begin to integrate the Venezuelan economy back into the Western global system.
And what was Rubio's framing for all this?
He framed the overarching goal as using every tool to eradicate these threats from our backyard, referring to the instability caused by the Maduro regime.
And the final phase, transition, is entirely structured by the leverage that was established in phase one.
Precisely. Phase three is transition. It envisions a political transformation led by the Venezuelan people, but that transformation is fundamentally structured by the financial control the U.S. established in phase one, the control over the oil assets. The U.S. holds the economic leverage necessary to shape the future political landscape.
If we connect this back to grand strategy, this is the most vigorous, high-stakes reassertion of the Monroe Doctrine we've seen in decades. But let's be honest, enforcing a naval blockade and seizing assets using kinetic force is, well, it's an act of war under international law. What diplomatic maneuvers were required to manage the international blowback?
The diplomatic activity was frantic, which reflects the high legal risk. Secretary Rubio was engaged in high-level coordination with the G7 foreign ministers to secure Western backing for the stabilization efforts and the oil seizure. At the same time, he held crucial meetings with the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud, to coordinate global energy supply and make sure the controlled flow of Venezuelan oil doesn't destabilize Saudi interests or the broader OPEC Plus agreements.
And this kinetic action is also being framed as a demonstration of superior military capability.
It is. Operation Absolute Resolve is specifically being touted as a geopolitical victory, demonstrating U.S. technological and operational superiority against sophisticated defense systems. The administration claims that the operation successfully navigated and overwhelmed Chinese, Russian, and Iranian defense systems. We're talking advanced radar, missile systems, drone assets that had been deployed and integrated into Venezuela's defense architecture.
So it's a message for Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing, not just Caracas?
Absolutely.
That structural change in the military and the kinetic diplomacy in Venezuela set the stage perfectly for the next major executive pivot, a hard decoupling from the architecture of global governance itself.
This is the third pillar of the executive strategy. It involves the systemic dismantling of structures the administration views as hostile. The action is the formal withdrawal of the United States from 66 international organizations, executing the mandate of Executive Order 14199.
66 organizations. That's an administrative purge on a scale we haven't seen since the end of the Cold War. What's the common thread among these targeted entities?
The State Department, which is responsible for executing this, characterized these entities as part of a sprawling architecture of global governance that has, in the administration's view, been captured by progressive ideologies.
What does that mean? What's the specific language?
The specific language used in the mandate targeted organizations promoting concepts like DEI mandates, gender equity campaigns, and climate orthodoxy. The executive branch is explicitly targeting what it calls the NGOplex, meaning non-governmental organizations or multilateral bodies that get substantial U.S. funding, but whose missions are now deemed contrary to current U.S. political values.
And the rationale is simply ceasing funding, protect the treasury.
Precisely. The stated justification is protecting the blood, sweat, and treasure of the American people by cutting off funding for organizations that are categorized as wasteful, ineffective, or harmful. It fundamentally signals that U.S. multilateral engagement outside of direct bilateral treaties is going to be conditioned solely on ideological alignment with the current administration's specific social and political mandates.
Let's discuss the global consequences. If 66 organizations lose U.S. funding, what does this mean for their solvency?
The impact is designed to be destructive. The U.S. contribution often makes up a significant portion of these organizations' operational budgets, frequently 22% or more. This massive, immediate stop in funding will likely precipitate immediate solvency crises for many mid-tier multilateral bodies, leading to significant restructuring, mergers, or, you know, outright dissolution. It formalizes a hard decoupling from the post-1945 consensus.
So the administration is deliberately ceding influence in these forums.
They are. They're calculating that the money saved and the sovereignty retained by leaving outweigh any diplomatic benefits of continued membership. They seem to believe these organizations are already ideologically compromised beyond repair.
Before we leave the executive branch, we need to quickly wrap up the trade continuity action, specifically Proclamation 10999, because it ties directly back to how the military budget is being justified.
That's the final piece of the executive puzzle. Proclamation 10999 was issued, titled "To Implement the United States-Israel Agreement on Trade in Agricultural Products and for Other Purposes."
Give me the technical filing details.
It was filed for public inspection yesterday at 11:15 a.m., and it's issued under the authority of the original United States-Israel Free Trade Area Implementation Act of 1985. The action extends duty-free treatment and modifies the Harmonized Tariff Schedule of the United States, or HTSUS, for specific agricultural products. Historically, these trade protocols ensure U.S. agricultural access for commodities like corn, wheat flour, soybean oil, and poultry.
So on one hand, The U.S. is aggressively withdrawing from the multilateral system, but on the other, it's ensuring bilateral trade continuity with key allies.
Exactly. It ensures stable market access for the U.S. agricultural sector. And the connection back to the Department of War is financial. President Trump is using the anticipated revenue generated by tariffs from other countries, the tremendous numbers being produced by tariffs, as he put it, as the justification for calling for a massive $1.5 trillion DoD Department of War budget for the next fiscal year.
So it operationally links trade protectionism directly to increased military spending.
It's a direct link.
We've covered the aggressive clarity of the executive branch. Now let's pivot sharply to the fractured, complex, and highly procedural landscape of the legislative branch Congress. Here, the story is not one of unified power, but of internal revolt.
That domestic fracture was on full display in the House yesterday, centered on healthcare funding. We saw a rare and consequential procedural maneuver. The successful House discharge petition victory regarding the Affordable Care Act subsidies.
For our listeners who aren't legislative procedure fanatics, explain what a discharge petition is and why succeeding at one is so profound.
A discharge petition is essentially the legislative nuclear option for the minority party, or in this case, a bipartisan coalition. It's a procedural tool that allows a majority of the House, that's 218 signatures, to seize control of a bill that has been intentionally stalled by the majority leadership in a committee, usually the Rules Committee.
So it bypasses leadership completely?
Completely. Once it's discharged, the bill immediately moves to the floor for a vote. It's extremely rare, precisely because it signals that the Speaker has lost control of the floor agenda.
The vehicle used here was HRES 780. What was the exact vote count?
The motion to discharge the Committee on Rules passed 221 yeas to 205 nays.
And the breakdown of those 221 yeas tells the whole political story of the day.
It absolutely does. The 221 votes include all 212 voting Democrats, plus a critical defection of 9 Republican members who broke ranks to provide the necessary margin. Those 9 Republicans, who are mostly centrists or members from swing districts, they effectively delivered the majority's defeat.
This action paves the way for the underlying policy, the extension of the ACA subsidies. What's the immediate policy consequence for millions of Americans?
HRES 780 is the vehicle for HR 1834, which seeks to extend the pandemic-era ACA subsidies, which actually expired on January 1st, 2026, for 3 more years. Proponents stress that this extension is crucial to prevent millions, the number is around 22 million people, from losing coverage or facing crippling immediate premium spikes.
The cost is the immediate political flashpoint.
Sure.
What are the numbers being thrown around?
The price tag is the main source of contention. Critics estimate the 3-year extension will cost $110 billion. More conservative groups are warning that by extending these subsidies, this becomes a prelude to permanence and could lock in over $400 billion in long-term federal spending, fundamentally cementing a huge expansion of the ACA.
So we have a profound legislative crisis for the majority. What's the immediate goal for the 9 Republicans who defected, given that the underlying bill is now highly likely to pass the House?
Their goal is leverage, not necessarily immediate passage of the full Democratic bill. Defectors are pushing for a swift compromise deal in the Senate. They want to use the momentum from the discharge petition to force a bipartisan framework that offers a shorter extension coupled with some structural reforms.
What does that Senate compromise framework look like in detail?
The likely compromise involves a shorter duration, maybe a 2-year extension, coupled with crucial GOP demands like establishing minimum premium payments and implementing strict income caps for who gets the subsidy. The ultimate conservative goal is to shift the program away from directly subsidizing insurance companies and towards something like health savings accounts, where the money flows directly to consumers.
But the perennial hurdle in all healthcare deals remains, the so-called poison pill.
That's the Hyde Amendment issue. GOP negotiators have made it clear that any final compromise must explicitly restrict federally funded marketplace plans from covering abortion services. Democrats, however, argue that current law already separates federal and private funds, and they view any additional restriction as an unacceptable political attack, a poison pill.
So a non-starter.
A non-starter. The only potential softening came from some reports that President Trump had privately urged House Republicans to show flexibility on Hyde just to secure a general win on health care policy.
Moving from general health care policy to the specific health care needs of the military and veterans, let's look at the bipartisan effort to streamline medical credentialing between the DoD and the VA.
This is an excellent example of highly functional, detailed legislative work. a bipartisan group, Senators Jackie Rosen and Marsha Blackburn, and Representatives Greg Murphy and Susie Lee introduced companion bills titled the Department of Defense and Department of Veterans Affairs Medical Credentialing Integration Act of 2025.
What specific deadlines and requirements does this bill impose on these massive agencies?
The bill requires two key action points. First, the DOD and the VA have to jointly select a single credentialing and privileging system by January 2027. Second, they must notify Congress that the system is fully operational by 2028. It also mandates an initial report assessing the current separate systems for, you know, technical issues, data storage, portability, interoperability, and current operational gaps.
What bureaucratic failure are they targeting with this legislation? What's the problem they're trying to solve?
They're targeting massive administrative redundancy. Right now, providers who switch between DOD facilities and VA facilities are forced to restart a complex, months-long credentialing and privileging approval process from scratch. This red tape delays access to care for service members and veterans, and it contributes directly to staffing shortages.
And it seems like the DOD already has a model for this.
They do. Just in October, the DOD extended the renewal window for clinical privileges from 2 years to 3 years for clinicians moving between military treatment facilities. This new legislation is basically trying to force that same efficiency across the entire federal health enterprise serving our uniformed personnel and veterans.
Staying within Congress, let's cover the highly polarized committee oversight hearing concerning fraud and misuse of federal funds in Minnesota.
The Oversight and Government Reform Committee held a hearing yesterday titled Oversight of Fraud and Misuse of Federal Funds in Minnesota, Part 1. And this hearing was politically explosive from the outset.
What were the Republican accusations regarding the scope of the fraud and the actors involved?
Republicans focused on two specific numbers and one political implication. House Majority Whip Tom Emmer explicitly questioned whether Democratic Governor Tim Walz knew about the alleged $9 billion in federal funds fraud that occurred during his tenure. Republicans also highlighted the $250 million Feeding Our Future COVID fraud scheme, stressing the specific data point that 90% of those charged or indicted in that specific case were of Somali descent.
And how did Democrats on the committee counter this? Let's make sure we're being strictly impartial in reporting this political conflict.
Congressional Democrats immediately framed the hearing as a political exercise targeting a specific community. Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett demanded clarification from witnesses, asking pointedly whether they believed all Somali Americans were involved in fraud. And then Congressman Robert Garcia challenged the Republican emphasis by detailing instances where President Trump had pardoned convicted fraudsters of federal programs, specifically naming high-profile white-collar criminals like Philip S. Forms, Joseph Schwartz, and Paul Walczak.
So his point was to expose perceived hypocrisy.
Exactly. He concluded by saying, the state will ensure there is a full, fair, and expeditious investigation to ensure accountability and justice. The core conflict was really about the politicization of data and federal law enforcement. It was less about how to recover the money and more about assigning political blame.
Before we move to the agency deep dives, we have to cover the appropriation package the House advanced. This is crucial for avoiding a government shutdown.
That's right. The House advanced a bipartisan package of fiscal year 2026 spending bills. This package included the Commerce, Justice, Science, Energy, Water, and Interior EPA appropriations bills.
Why is this action significant in the current highly fractured legislative environment?
It signifies a concerted move toward regular order. Regular order means passing individual appropriations bills through committee rather than relying on massive last-minute omnibus spending packages. Advancing these three bipartisan bills shows that despite the internal crisis exposed by the discharge petition, Congress is at least attempting to adhere to a structured appropriations process to avoid a government shutdown later this year. It's a small functional victory for legislative stability.
Now, let's transition from Congress to the executive agencies, starting with the most immediate and volatile domestic flashpoint of the day, the deadly clash in Minneapolis involving federal law enforcement.
This incident instantly encapsulated the domestic fracture we just discussed. It pits the aggressive posture of federal law enforcement directly against local Democratic leadership. The action is tragic. An ICE officer fatally shot 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis during a targeted enforcement operation. The FBI is now conducting a joint investigation with the Minneapolis Police Department.
And we have two completely divergent, mutually exclusive narratives. Let's start with the official DHS account provided by Secretary Kristi Noem.
DHS stated that the incident occurred when one of the ICE vehicles got stuck in the snow. Secretary Nolim confirmed that the woman, Renee Good, had been stalking and impeding officers all throughout the day, and that she refused verbal commands. The DHS narrative then escalated dramatically, claiming the woman weaponized her vehicle and attempted to run an officer over.
And the secretary used highly charged language to classify this act.
She did. Secretary Nolim explicitly called it an act of domestic terrorism, asserting the officer acted defensively and completely within his training protocols. She also provided context for the officer's defensive posture, noting he had been hospitalized and released and was the same officer who was previously dragged by a protester back in June. And then she quantified the threat, claiming DHS is facing a massive 1,300% increase in assaults and an astronomical 8,000% increase in death threats against its personnel.
This framing of the incident is domestic terrorism is a key part of the federal strategy.
It is. Secretary Nolim publicly requested that the Department of Justice prosecute the vehicle ramming as domestic terrorism, claiming the behavior isn't spontaneous but coordinated. She specifically stated, "People are being trained and told how to use their vehicles as weapons."
Okay, now let's look at the counter-narrative from local officials and Democrats.
The local response was one of outrage and immediate escalation. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey publicly demanded that ICE get the F out of our city, stating unequivocally that the death was the result of an agent recklessly using power. He dismissed the DHS narrative as bull's long. Similarly, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz called the DHS narrative a propaganda machine and, in a massive escalation, warned that the Minnesota National Guard is on alert.
And congressional Democrats immediately pointed to federal guidelines that appear to contradict the officers' actions.
They did. Glenn Ivey noted that DHS guidelines generally prohibit officers from discharging firearms at the operator of a moving vehicle. They also stressed the fact that Renee Good was unarmed.
So this incident is the operational outcome of the administration's strategy of surging federal law enforcement, specifically a surge of 2,000 agents into the Twin Cities.
Exactly. And it's colliding head-on with a sanctuary city environment. The divide couldn't be starker. Federal agents calling an act terrorism, local officials calling it murder. And DHS stated yesterday that operations are absolutely not paused. Agents remain deployed in the city.
Shifting gears completely, and this is an abrupt transition, but necessary, let's look at a completely different agency mandate. The revolutionary overhaul of federal nutrition policy by HHS and USDA.
This is truly a seismic shift. The White House, spearheaded by HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and CMS Administrator Mehmet Oz, unveiled new dietary guidelines, describing them as the most significant reset of federal nutrition policy in history. The visual centerpiece of this overhaul is the upside-down pyramid displayed on the new official website, realfood.gov.
Describe the architecture of this upside-down pyramid and how it differs from the decades-long standard guidance.
The new pyramid completely inverts the previous model. The top, which represents the foods you should prioritize, now features proteins, healthy fats, fruits, and vegetables. It's emphasizing nutrient-dense whole foods. And critically, whole grains are relegated to the bottom, which is a radical departure from the original 1990s pyramid that prioritized, 8 to 11 servings of bread and pasta at the foundation.
Let's detail the three key policy changes that overturned previous conventional guidance. Start with the war on saturated fats.
Key change one addresses saturated fats and dairy. Secretary Kennedy declared an end to the war on saturated fats. The new guidance explicitly encourages the consumption of full-fat dairy with no added sugars and red meat, noting that dairy in its whole form is an excellent source of protein and healthy fats.
But there's a nuance there, isn't there?
There is. The long-held guidance to limit total saturated fat consumption to 10% of daily caloric intake was technically maintained. So it created a mixed message that drew criticism from organizations like the American Heart Association.
Change 2 is an explicit targeting of modern industrial food production.
It is a war on added sugar and highly processed foods, Secretary Kennedy stated. Today, our government declares war on added sugar, highly processed foods. The guidance specifies a rigid avoidance of sugar-sweetened beverages and refined carbohydrates, and Administrator Oz provided the data point for this, stating that 60% to 70% of the calories consumed by American children today come from ultra-processed food.
And finally, change 3 involves alcohol recommendations, moving away from previous moderation guidelines.
The new guidance is simply recommending people consume less alcohol for better overall health. It's a deliberate shift away from the specific previous guidelines of 2 drinks for men and 1 for women, which Administrator Oz stated was never properly supported by robust data.
What's the underlying ideological justification for this revolutionary reset?
Secretary Kennedy was extremely candid. He stated that the government has been lying to us to protect corporate profit-taking, promoting what he called food-like substances. The administration argues that whole nutrient-dense food is the most powerful and cost-effective path to improving public health and lowering healthcare costs.
And the application of these new guidelines means this change will be felt almost immediately across the entire federal apparatus.
Absolutely. These guidelines will be applied across every major federal feeding program. That includes Head Start, the administration of 45 million school lunches daily, meals for the 1.3 million active duty service members, and food served to the 9 million veterans in VA hospitals. It's a massive demand signal shift away from processed ingredients toward whole foods in the American food supply chain.
Moving from the American diet to the data that governs the country, let's turn to the alarming report on the crisis in federal statistical infrastructure. This feels like the foundation upon which all these other policies are built.
This is arguably the most critical structural risk identified yesterday. The American Statistical Association released a report highlighting that the decentralized federal statistical system, which is made up of 13 primary agencies, including the Census Bureau, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is now officially labeled as at risk.
Let's talk numbers. How severe are the staffing losses across these critical data agencies?
They are devastating. They're ranging from 20% to 30% in the last year alone. The crisis is typified by the National Center for Education Statistics in the Department of Education, which lost its leader and was left with only three remaining staff members.
These people.
Three. And the impact is operational. The Census Bureau has been forced to cancel scheduled field operations, including special censuses they conduct for rapidly growing localities that need population updates.
Beyond the capacity crisis, the report highlights a crisis of public trust in the data itself.
Public trust has significantly eroded, dropping from 57% to 52% in just 4 months between June and September. The report attributes this decline to two factors: public concern over federal data potentially being used for law enforcement, and the political rhetoric that has publicly impugned data quality, like the firing of the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
So what does this at-risk label mean for the practical functioning of the U.S. government? Why should the average listener care if the BEA or BLS is short-staffed?
It means the fundamental infrastructure of decision-making is unstable. Statistical data is essential infrastructure. It's the foundation for everything from the Federal Reserve's decisions on interest rates to the allocation of federal assistance. The report emphasizes that this instability jeopardizes the fair and accurate distribution of trillions of dollars in federal assistance, simply because the data used to calculate need is now questionable.
What concrete steps are they recommending to fix this?
They're calling for a comprehensive modernization strategy with some muscle. This includes legislative solutions like statutory changes to protect the independence of the statistical agencies, establishing a strong chief statistician position within OMB to coordinate efforts, and dedicated funding for external research to drive innovation before the system breaks completely.
Moving from government infrastructure to personal financial infrastructure, let's detail the major structural changes coming to student loan policies from the Department of Education.
This is a major transformation, covering repayment options, borrowing limits, and collection methods.
Let's start with repayment, the elimination of the popular SAVE plan.
That's correct. The new, less generous repayment assistance plan is set to become the only income-driven repayment option available for new borrowers. The Biden-era SAVE plan, which was the most generous IDR plan ever created, is likely to fully shut down pending court approval.
What about existing borrowers?
Existing borrowers will be allowed to remain on their current IDR plans for now. But any new loans taken out or any attempt to consolidate existing loans will only make them eligible for the new, less generous plan.
The administration is also implementing significant new borrowing caps, specifically targeting higher education costs. What are the specific dollar limits being imposed?
These are highly specific new limits. They will cap borrowing for graduate students at $20,500 per year, professional programs like law and medicine at a strict limit of $50,000 per year, and parent PLUS borrowers will face a cap of $65,000 per child.
What's the stated rationale for imposing these caps, and what's the immediate concern from student advocates?
The administration argues this is intended to inject pricing discipline into higher education, forcing schools to lower their tuition. But advocates immediately voiced concern that these strict caps will disproportionately restrict access to pricier schools for lower-income students.
Beyond the structural changes, we are also seeing the resumption of aggressive enforcement actions that have been paused for 5 years.
Yes, the five-year pause that began during the pandemic is ending. Wage garnishment, which allows the department to seize up to 15% of a person's paycheck, is resuming for at least 1,000 defaulted borrowers this month. This will be followed quickly by the seizure of tax refunds.
And what's the predicted impact?
Analysts predict the number of Americans with federal student loans in default will soar, with predictions that the total could reach 10 million soon.
And finally, there are highly contentious changes coming to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness, PSLF, program, redefining who qualifies for debt cancellation.
Changes expected in July will redefine public service. The new rules will exclude nonprofits involved in unlawful activities, which the administration has explicitly defined as including organizations supporting gender transition in minors or those deemed to be abetting illegal immigration. This ideological definition is highly contested and is already facing numerous legal challenges.
Let's wrap up our agency deep dives by returning to the military, the Department of War, and focusing on acquisition and the critical, dense world of cybersecurity compliance.
On the modernization front, the Army launched the new Army Training Information System, ATS, replacing the legacy system. This platform uses agile software to provide soldiers and commanders with real-time visibility into training records aimed at reducing administrative time.
But the real operational focus for contractors is the strict, unavoidable enforcement of the cybersecurity rules, specifically the CMMC DeForest Clause. This is dense regulatory language, so we need maximum clarity here.
Absolutely. The CMMC DeForest 252.204.7021 clause is now fully active. For every single defense contractor, the critical insight is understanding the role of the contracting officer, or KO.
What is that role? What's the key language?
The KO's role is mandatory, indicated by the legal term shall. The KO shall insert the required Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, or CMMC, level into the contract. And critically, the KO shall not award a contract to an offeror without a current CMMC status at the required level. This removes any discretionary ability for the KO to issue waivers or exceptions.
So no compliance, no contract. How does the KO verify this status throughout the life of the contract?
The KO verifies it digitally in the Supplier Performance Risk System. SPRS. Mm-hmm. Contractors must provide their unique 10-character alphanumeric CMMC unique identifier, UID. Verification is mandatory at 3 points, initial award, any option exercise, and for any performance extensions.
What about flexibility? What if a contractor isn't fully compliant yet? What about conditional status and plans of action?
Conditional status is only permitted for level 2 and level 3. If a conditional status is accepted, it is strictly time-bound to 180 days from the status date. The contractor has to close out all deficiencies within that 180-day window to achieve full status. And crucially, the rule is absolute. No POANMs or plans of action are allowed for CMMC level 1.
So the message from the Department of War acquisition community is clear. If your status in SPRS isn't current at the required level, the KO's instruction is simple. No award, no extension.
No wiggle room at all.
To complete the picture of the Department of War acquisition environment, we have to revisit the executive order President Trump issued, specifically targeting the financial practices of defense contractors.
This was a blunt intervention into private sector financial governance. President Trump signed an executive order capping executive compensation for defense company executives at $5 million and, even more dramatically, prohibiting defense companies from issuing dividends or conducting stock buybacks.
What was the administration's stated justification for intervening so aggressively in the shareholder actions of private defense firms?
The justification was rooted in a belief that these firms are prioritizing short-term shareholder returns over long-term capability. The administration stated that companies were issuing massive dividends and stock buybacks at the expense and detriment of investing in plants and equipment.
And he didn't just issue a blanket order, he singled out one major contractor specifically.
He took explicit aim at RTX, which is Raytheon. He called them the least responsive to the needs of the DoD, the slowest in increasing their volume, and the most aggressive spending on their shareholders. He issued a direct warning that Raytheon must step up investments in new and modern production plants, or they will risk their relationship with the Department of War.
And this threat was delivered in the context of his call for the massive DoD budget.
Exactly. His call for the $1.5 trillion DoD budget. The message is, the government is increasing funding, and the contractors must reciprocate by increasing capacity, not just shareholder payouts.
Okay, that gives us the full, dense archival record for the day. So what does this all mean when we synthesize the aggressive geopolitical shifts with the immediate, tangible effects on American citizens?
The synthesis is defined by radical unilateralism abroad and structural fracture at home. The executive branch is aggressively reshaping the state apparatus toward a nationalist sovereignty-first doctrine. The militarization of diplomacy, evidenced by the rebranding to the Department of War and the kinetic blockade of Venezuela, signals a rejection of diplomatic gradualism in favor of coercive, decisive force.
And that hard stance is mirrored in the break from the post-war order.
Right, reinforced by the withdrawal from 66 international organizations. But domestically, the picture is one of immediate, intense conflict.
The government is revealing its fragility.
It is. The success of the House discharge petition highlights the majority's tenuous control and the ability of a bipartisan coalition to seize the legislative agenda on massive spending like the ACA subsidies. At the same time, the lethal confrontation in Minneapolis is the operational outcome of aggressive federal law enforcement surges colliding head-on with local sanctuary policies.
And we've also seen massive regulatory pivots that will reshape Americans' daily lives. From the new student loan policies that will restrict graduate borrowing and resume aggressive wage garnishment, to the complete reset of federal nutrition guidelines.
Right. The entire operational structure is in motion. But I think the final, most crucial point, the one we leave you to mull over, connects back to the unseen foundation upon which every policy we discuss rests, the statistical infrastructure of the nation.
The knowledge base that determines financial allocation.
Exactly. We covered the alarming report that the federal statistical system is at risk, citing staff losses of 20% to 30% and the cancellation of vital census operations. Now, let's contextualize the true weight of that. Sean Moulton, a key policy expert, noted that 371 federal assistance programs, accounting for a massive $2.2 trillion in a single fiscal year, relied directly on accurate census data and other federal statistics.
$2.2 trillion. That's funding schools, clinics, roads, infrastructure projects across the entire country.
Right. So if the infrastructure that determines where that $2.2 trillion is distributed is rapidly losing staff, has to cancel field operations, and is facing a massive collapse in public trust, what does that mean for the fair, accurate, and effective functioning of American society?
The inability to rely on objective data compromises the core capacity of the government to make rational decisions.
It affects everything from interest rates to the equitable distribution of federal aid to our most vulnerable communities.
That is the ultimate question. When the foundation of data integrity is compromised, how does the Department of War plan its budget? How do we evaluate the necessity of ACA subsidies? And how do we even measure the success of the new nutrition policy? That statistical risk permeates every single action we covered today.
A question worth carrying forward.
Food for thought, indeed. Thank you for diving into the archives with us on The Deep Dive.
Thank you.